Argument is Tartt versus Northwest Community Hospital. Mr. Mishaya.
Counsel, morning. Co-counsel, morning.
Your Honors, good morning. I have several points to make. One point, Your Honors, is that I take the position that the district court erred when it ruled on October 1st, 2004, that defended National Community Hospitals, it granted their motion to strike the plaintiff's answers to the motion to dismiss our amended complaint. Now, we had a status call on February 27th, 2004. We were granted leave to file our second amended complaint. We filed that complaint on April 23rd, 2004. On May 13th, when we stepped up, the court set a briefing schedule because the defendant stated they wanted to file a motion to dismiss our second amended complaint. They were to file this by May 27th, 2004. We were to respond by June 10th, 2004, and then the reply was due June 17th. That is in volume 2 of 2 of the record number 88. Your Honors, on May 27th, Attorney Childs and myself did receive our motions to dismiss from Northwest Community Hospital. However, Attorney Childs did not receive the motion from defendant Northwest Suburban Anesthesiologist until June 3rd of 04, and I never got it from them. Attorney Childs and I discussed it, and I got a copy of that particular motion from Attorney Childs on June 7th of 04. So whereas we had originally 14 days to respond, Attorney Childs then had 7 and myself 3, which as we were on the case together, we then had 3 days. That's in volume 2 of 2 of the record, number 92.
Don't you have a res judicata problem apart from all this procedural stuff?
Regarding the res judicata, Your Honor, this court held, when this matter was up by Mr. Tartt for an appeal, this court held that the district court erred when it ruled that the First Amendment complaint was barred by res judicata. The district court, under the misapprehension that both cases contained the same claims against the same defendants, erred. That's Tartt versus Northwest Community Hospital and Northwest Suburban Anesthesiologist, 03-1558 at 4, 7th Circuit. The minute order, Your Honor, of October 1st, the district court, and there the district court stated that instead of filing our motion for leave to file our answers, that we file something titled "We need leave of court" or something, and he stated that we both admitted that we got the complaints, the motions on May 27th. And that Attorney Childs admitted he got his on June 3rd, and that we did not explain why 1 week was insufficient to prepare a response. Mind you, this is why we asked for and got 14 days to prepare a response, but then ended up with, in effect, 3 days. The court never addressed in this minute order the fact that I never got anything from Northwest Suburban Anesthesiologists. And the court stated that we did not explain why we failed to ask for more time, said we failed to meet the court's imposed deadline without a reasonable explanation. Volume 2 of 2 of the record, number 101, pages 5-6. But, Your Honor, in the motion for leave, we explained to the district court that the reason we needed more time was because we did not get our responses timely, the motions from the defendants. We had a status call set for July 9th, and we were asking for leave to file those in stanter on that date. However, on July 8th, the district court sent out a minute order striking the July 9th date and telling the defendants to respond to our motion for leave, to respond to their motions. So we never got a chance to step up to explain to the court, although we did have it in our motion as to why we were filing this late. And we did file that on time, which was June 10th, which is when our answers were due. Second point, I take to position, Your Honors, that the district court erred when it granted defendants, Northwest Community Hospital, and Northwest Suburban Anesthesiologists motions to dismiss our Second Amendment complaint. The court said that our claims are barred on the same factual nebulae as prior claims in 00C7959, which was dismissed when the plaintiff was pro se. So the court said that res judicata applied. But again, I have addressed that issue with Your Honors as to what this court held regarding the issue of res judicata. Another issue that the district court ruled on regarding the motion to dismiss was a Rule 12b-6. And regarding that, this court has held that if a complaint places the defendant and the court on notice of the plaintiff's claims, then it states a claim for which relief can be granted. Davis versus Ruby Foods, 269 Fed 3rd, 8.
What I don't understand is Judge Norgal dismissed one of the one of the suits on the merits, prejudice, and the two suits are identical, aren't they?
No, they're not, Your Honor.
What's the difference? Just a party? One is the hospital is a party to one, not the other? Any other difference?
The difference, Your Honor, was cited in this court's ruling in Todd versus Northwest Community Hospital, when this court and Northwest Suburban Anesthesiologists, when it said that the district court was under the misapprehension that both cases contained the same claims against the same defendants. That's 03-1558 at 4, page 4. This court made that ruling when the plaintiff went up on appeal pro se before Your Honors. That was this court's ruling.
Was there a res judicata issue raised then?
Yes, it was. And this court said that there was no res judicata. The court said that the district court was under the misapprehension that res judicata applied. And this court reversed and remanded the case back to George Norgal on that basis on October 23rd, 2003.
Was that because there was an additional party in the other case?
No, Your Honor. Those parties have been the same throughout the pendency of this case.
Well, but one case had both parties and the other case only had one as a defendant, right?
Yeah, yes, but the complaints that are before this court, the complaint that was before the court on that one issue was containing the same factual basis. The facts never changed.
But what's the difference between the two suits then?
The difference between the First Amendment complaint and the Second Amendment complaint?
No, the two different suits with the two different numbers, the two different cases. Got two different cases.
Oh, well, the 7959 was dismissed, and that case was a different case.
What's the difference between the two cases? That's what I'm asking. Well, that's all right.
Well, 7959 was only against NSA, right?
Yes.
And the 7960 was against both NSA and the hospital.
Right, right. That's what I said.
Is that the only difference?
Yes, I see it, yes.
Okay, well, thank you. You want to save the rest of your time for rebuttal?
Okay.
Mr. Broman?
May it please the court, Michael Broma on behalf of Northwest Suburban Anesthesiologists, or NSA, the former employer of Dr. Tartt. I think at the outset, let's deal with the res judicata issue. The earlier appellate court ruling, which Dr. Tartt's attorney has referred to, is attached to Appendix 5 of our brief. You read that, you'll see there's absolutely no discussion whatsoever of any res judicata issue. The 7959 case, which proceeded solely against my client, is identical to the 7960 case as far as factual allegations, as far as the causes of action stated. Dr. Tartt fully litigated the 7959 case before Judge Nordicle.
He was pro se when he filed a complaint.
No. Well, when he filed his original complaint in 2000, he was proceeding pro se. By the summer of 2001, he had retained counsel. And then, I think he was on a second set of lawyers by the time that he amended his complaint in the 59 case. And the 59 case was a complaint that was filed by lawyers that he proceeded with. In fact, I believe it's the same lawyers that are representing him now in both cases. So he was not proceeding pro se with respect to the amended complaint that Judge Nordicle dismissed on January of 2003. The res judicata issue, I think there should be no dispute. This case and the 59 case meet res judicata on all three prongs. There was a final judgment in the 7959 case because there was a with prejudice dismissal on both 12b-6 and 41b grounds. There was an identity of the parties in that both cases involved NSA and Dr. Tartt, and there was an identity of causes of action. They were the same core of operative facts, the same transactions. We've attached as Appendix 2 and 3 to our brief the two complaints in the two cases for you to compare. They're the same basic background facts, the same alleged deprivations of retirement and pension benefits, of stock ownership, of promotion, of salary, of training and retraining. Just look at paragraph 5 of the 79 complaint and paragraph 28 of the 7960 complaint, and you'll see that the words are basically identical. And it's even as counsel has admitted here, the only difference was that in the 59 case, it was proceeding solely against NSA, and in the 60 case, it was both NSA and the hospital. So quite clearly, res judicata bars his proceeding in the 79 case, certainly against NSA. That's all I have to say. Thank you,
Mr. Broman. Mr. Hucker?
Good morning, Your Honor. Tartt never argued at the district court level, and he has not argued in respect to this appeal, that the hospital is not in privity with NSA. And he has waived his right to challenge it now. If you look at the briefs, if you look at the history, and this is a convoluted procedural history for these two cases, all of his claims flow from the relationship established by his contracts with NSA. As he would not have obtained privileges at the hospital or provided services at the hospital other than when he was employed by NSA. The hospital was drawn into this dispute because Tartt signed an employment agreement with NSA. It's in the record at number 87, Exhibit A. Tartt entered into an amended agreement with NSA after his return from military service. That's in the record at 87, Exhibit B. Tartt's employment with NSA was terminated, thus triggering his obligation to leave the hospital. There's a clear congruity of legal issues, a close identity of interest here.
And is the contract between NSA and the hospital in the record?
The contract between NSA and the hospital is also in the record, I believe, at Exhibit 87. But the contract, and it's an exclusive arrangement, which, as the court is aware, is something that's recognized under Illinois law. It's not something uncommon for hospitals to have partially closed medical staffs and to contract with groups of physicians and to have the relationship then dependent on whether or not that person remains employed.
Under that contract, who had the right to hire and discharge?
The only person that had the right to hire and discharge was NSA. The hospital had no control over that. Thus, if he was no longer an employee, he no longer could provide services at NSA without breaching, I'm sorry, at the hospital without breaching.
How did he, in fact, then perform some services, apparently, before entering the armed forces? There was a hiatus of 1 month, I believe, in which
correct.
It's alleged that he moonlighted, in effect.
Well, scheduling, people sometimes don't catch up. And since he technically had not left NSA, the hospital wouldn't have had notice that he was no longer employed by NSA.
But yet you paid him and not the corporation.
I think what happened was that he billed patients and collected the money and failed to remit it to the to NSA. And that would be a pretty standard practice that an anesthesiologist would have a separate billing. And it would be very common then for him, similar to me as a lawyer in a law firm, a client may pay me, but I have an obligation to pay my firm or to turn over any funds that I receive as a partner at McDermott, Will & Emery. I can't keep the money just because of the fact that I provided services and a patient provided it to, or a client provided it to me.
Thank you.
Separate and apart from the res judicata issue, which we believe is dispositive in this case, his Title VII claim and his USERRA claim as it relates to the hospital fails for two essential reasons. First and foremost, he was never our employee in either instance. And second, with respect to the Title VII action, he hasn't complied with what is required under the law for him to pursue such a claim. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Harker. Mr. Mishaya, how much time does he have? 1 minute. Okay, do you have anything further?
Your Honor, this case has never been fully litigated. We got in this case after this case was sent back down by this honorable court. We filed a complaint. We asked for time to bring this matter before a trial of fact. We've been denied that. This man's fundamental right of being able to have his day in court is being denied. And the procedural matter before this court, which is the only issue before this court, is that we were told that we had 14 days to answer. We were given 3. And that's fundamentally unfair. What we're asking this honorable court for is to send this matter back so that we can have our day in court. We haven't even got a complaint on file. To get past that point is all we're asking this court to help us do. Just give us the fundamental fairness of letting this man be heard, because what was said about him billing is not true, but that's not before this court. We want that to go before the trial of fact. So with all due respect, Your Honors, I respectfully ask that reverse and remand this case back like you did in October of 2003 so that we can get this man his day in court and see what a trial of fact has to say. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Messiah, and Mr. Tucker and Mr. Broman.